Hello and welcome to another edition of Weapons and Warfare. For Straight Arrow News, I'm your host, Ryan Robertson. Just ahead on this week's episode. For decades, the Air Force was battling against a problem you might not expect. A shortage of pilots to carry out its wide array of missions. At this year's Air, Space, and Cyber Conference, several senior members of Air Force leadership gathered to talk about what they're doing to change that. Plus, you've probably heard of hydrogen-powered vehicles, but how about hydrogen-powered drones? In our Weapon of the Week, we visit with one startup that's trying to bring them to the battle space. But first, here are some headlines you may have missed. This summer, NORAD was busy keeping an eye on things when they spotted and tracked two Russian Tu-95s and two Chinese H-6 bombers flying in the Alaska Air Defense Identification Zone. That's when NORAD scrambled fighter jets from the US and Canada to intercept them. An Air Defense Identification Zone is where sovereign airspace ends and international airspace begins. It's a designated area where all aircraft need to be identified for national security reasons. While their presence raised eyebrows, it wasn't considered a threat as both the Russians and Chinese stayed in international airspace and did not cross into U.S. or Canadian territory. But it is another example of America's adversaries willing to test the boundaries of what they can get away with. In early November, U.S. Central Command executed a series of airstrikes on multiple Houthi weapons storage facilities in Yemen in response to two unsuccessful attacks on U.S. Navy warships with multiple drones and missiles as they were traveling through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. The Defense Department says the Iranian-backed Houthis launched at least 8 drones, 5 anti-ship ballistic missiles, and 3 anti-ship cruise missiles at the USS Stockdale and the USS Spruance, both Navy destroyers. Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder said there was no damage to the ships and no one was injured. That was followed by another attack on U.S. forces, this time at a mission support site in northeast Syria, prompting another U.S. response.
U.S. CENTCOM forces conducted strikes yesterday against 9 targets in 2 locations associated with Iranian groups in Syria in response to several attacks on U.S. personnel in Syria over a 24-hour period. These strikes will degrade the Iranian-backed group's ability to plan and launch future attacks on U.S. and coalition forces who are in the region to conduct defeat ISIS operations.
The Houthis insisted the attacks will continue as long as the wars against Hamas and Hezbollah continue. At the same time, a UN panel of experts is alleging the Houthis may be shaking down some shippers in the area for about $180 million a month for safe passage. A remarkable at-sea rescue happened over Veterans Day weekend, and it was all caught on camera. On November 8th, a crew from the 129th Rescue Wing of the California Air National Guard answered an urgent call for medical evacuation about 400 miles off the coast of San Diego. A fisherman aboard a chartered vessel began showing stroke-like symptoms that escalated into a matter of life and death. The crew of an HH-G60 Pavehawk rescue helicopter was able to lift the fisherman off the boat and get him life-saving care. The 79-year-old fisherman and Air Force veteran is now recovering at a San Diego area hospital. From the fictional, think Iceman and Maverick and Top Gun, to the real life, Chuck Yeager and Neil Armstrong in The Right Stuff, the image of a fighter pilot from any era is an iconic one. And for as long as there have been aircraft built to rule the skies, there have been brave men and women willing to climb into the cockpit and answer their country's call. But as each branch of the DoD continues to modernize for whatever conflicts come our way, they're all facing a very big problem. Not enough pilots to meet the needs of today's military. At the front of the line facing that issue is the U.S. Air Force. And that's the focus of this week's debrief. Well, there is no one specific cause for the shortage. The numbers add up to a serious problem. At this year's Airspace and Cyber Conference, Air Force leadership detailed how the service is short by nearly 2,000 pilots, more than 1,100 of which fall into the fighter pilot category.
Suffice it to say, it remains a chronic issue, as you have highlighted, and one that these gentlemen, I'm sure, will have great solutions to how we're going to fix it. It's all easy. We know it's not. It's very complex and, frankly, takes input from across the force to understand best how we do what the nation requires of us as an Air Force.
One way the Air Force is trying to tackle the problem is by changing how new pilots are trained and assigned to the Air Force's wide array of aircraft and their various missions. The goal is to reduce the length of time it takes to move candidates through the pipeline.
Today, the average officer is going to go to pilot training from a commission to pilot or being mission qualification in their platform, 528 days, give or take. If you're going to mobility, it's about 430 days. And it, you know, that's way too long. We need to get airmen on their mission, in their platform, in their combat squadron.
Lieutenant General Brian Robinson, commander of the Air Education and Training Command, also pointed to a program that allows candidates who already have a pilot's license and are looking to fly refuelers or cargo aircraft the chance to start in the T-1 Jayhawk, a medium-range twin-engine jet, rather than the traditional route of starting in the T-6. This can cut months off time spent in the pipeline and get pilots to their first assignments sooner.
We've had 16 folks go through the KC-135 portion. All have passed their check rides Q1. There's a couple not on the first time through, but that's normal. And the C-130J, we've had 22 go through. And again, all at low risk have met on time and passed their check rides.
For those set on flying fighters or bombers, they still start on the T-6 before moving on to the T-38. Once pilots graduate out of that phase, they typically move on to platforms like the F-16, F-35, and B-1. While the Air Force does try to pair grads with their aircraft of choice, they're now asking airmen to broaden the scope of what they're willing to fly. Think airlift or tankers as two examples.
It doesn't mean that if you go to T-38s, you're not going to get a fighter. It means that you might not get a fighter. One benefit to the member is that you continue to move through your pipeline more quickly, and you get to a flight line and an ops squadron sooner than you would have going another direction. We're looking at ways to ensure that there's still some element of choice and that merit matters. And so how well you do certainly will matter in some of these selections. But we also need to be aware that this is good for the Air Force, and we have to fight against those things that are hurting this pilot shortage and contributing to it, and find ways to overcome it.
Another avenue the Air Force is pursuing is making a concerted effort to keep pilots looking to leave active duty aware of the opportunities available in the Guard and Reserve components.
Everybody's life changes as you move through service, and you start a business, you have kids, family doesn't want to move around, whatever the reason is, the reserve component offers a position for you no matter what phase of life you're in.
We need this symbiotic relationship. It's not active duty versus reserve component or reserve component versus active duty. We want the right balance there. And, my message, I really hope you stay on active duty. But if you can't, I really need you to go to the reserve component so that I have access to your skills when the fight comes. Because that's really all I give a shit crap about.
Yeah!
To be real honest with you, right? When the fight comes, will we be ready, and will I have the forces to go implement our nation's interests with kinetic air power.
At this point, you might think, what if we just had fewer manned aircraft and relied more on unmanned platforms? To that point, retired Air Force General Jeffrey Harrigan offers this counter.
As we talk as, great power competition, I'd argue numbers are important, and I don't think you guys would argue with me. And so how we do that going forward, and we can talk about mixes of man and unmanned, but people matter. Warfighting is about humans. and humans are required to fly airplanes. And so we got to think our way through that.
With a cumulative 12 stars and decades of experience, the four airmen all agreed there's no one quick fix to this ongoing problem. They insist it will take a holistic approach to reach recruiting, training, and retention goals the Air Force has been chasing for years.
Serving you clarity through context, our mission at SAN is to deliver the news straight down the middle. We're different from mainstream media because we spotlight distorted headlines and show you how to do it too. Discover stories that right and left-leaning outlets are choosing not to cover by using our Media Mist tool. Download the SAN app and turn on notifications to have straight facts delivered right to your phone or tablet, and get straight facts anytime at SAN.com.
Spend enough time on the floor of a defense exposition and you'll find just about any kind of drone you can imagine. But recently we came across something we hadn't seen before, and that's why we chose Heaven Drones for our weapon of the week. To look at Heaven Drones' newest project, the H-2D-250, you might not think it's all that different from dozens of other similar-looking models looking to claim a piece of the marketplace. But the company's founder says it's what's under the hood that makes it something new with which to be reckoned.
We said we have to solve the energy piece. And when we're looking for the ideal energy source of drones, we got the hydrogen. So it's really one long story, which is how can drones do more, be flying robots, heavy lift, great. Getting to long endurance is what led us to hydrogen.
So why hydrogen? Levinson says it offers 3 to 5 times the energy density of traditional batteries, extending flight time by hours, pretty near ideal for places like the Indo-Pacific.
So it's highly pressurized hydrogen that is sitting in a tank, small amount, about a pound of hydrogen, that's it. And then we have a fuel cell. The fuel cell is taking that hydrogen and slowly making it into electricity. So we're kind of creating, it's like a power plant in the sky. So that's how it works. We're going from, again, 30 minutes to about 3 hours, and our new systems that actually include a wing can already achieve 10 hours of flight time.
Of course, operating in austere conditions, think a small island somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, presents a host of challenges. Levinson says their drones don't need much in the way of infrastructure. In fact, they don't even need to add fuel to the supply chain.
We actually have portable hydrogen refueling stations. So trailer-based, imagine your pickup truck or your Hummer, and there's solar panels on the roof. So wherever you are in the world, once you have the station, you're just creating your hydrogen, you're using it. So if you're on an island or wherever you are, there's no need to get more fuel or into the country. You're just creating your hydrogen in the thin air every single day.
Of course, the ultimate question is, what can Heaven's Drones provide to the warfighter? Levinson says they are focused on three aspects: logistics, a launch platform for other drones or ground robots, and finally, delivering munitions.
I think we as the U.S. and Israel, for example, realized over the past year, October 7th, that without its safety and security, our way of life, everything else is irrelevant. I think that we all have to work together, again, as individuals, right, as companies, etc., to make sure that, we as the U.S., we as the Western world, have the strength and have the capability to continue to live our lives in the way of freedom that we all believe in.
At the moment, Heaven's Drones is still working with the DoD and its various branches to secure a deal with U.S. forces. And if they are looking for proof of performance, they don't have to look too far.
Our drones are the leading drones working heavy lift in Israel today. We have a lot of experience on the ground actually scaling up, and we're just kind of getting ahead of the curve and what we're expecting for the conflicts in the years and decades to come.
If you're like me and you're thinking, this all sounds great, but isn't a hydrogen-powered drone super dangerous if it crashes or gets shot? Well, we asked Levinson that exact question, and he says while it may seem counterintuitive, they've done the testing to show hydrogen batteries are as safe or safer than traditional electric batteries. Time now for Comms Check, and we thought we'd check in with you, our viewers, to see what you have to say about some of our latest stories. So let's go ahead and get started. Our first comms check comes to us regarding our story on the Army's efforts to modernize and stay ahead of would-be adversaries. Jared Richards writes, "I'm pretty sure Russia is the most battle-hardened. I am an American, and I had to wake up to this fact." Okay, battle-hardened, maybe battle-unalived, Jared. The most recent casualty figures show Russian losses in the Ukraine war are approaching 750,000 people dead or wounded. Why do you think Moscow needs North Korean soldiers? Putting aside the fact the United States is still pretty fresh off of a two-decade domination of Iraq and Afghanistan, the vast majority of seasoned Russian soldiers and a good chunk of their battlefield commanders are dead, and dead folks don't share their wartime experience. All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Next up, our story on the USS Seawolf, one of America's nuclear-powered fast attack submarines, making a very visible appearance in Tokyo Bay recently, prompted one viewer to write this: "I don't think China cares anymore." We had to blur out the viewer's name, their tag, because it's just not appropriate for air. But, dear viewer, China most assuredly cares. I promise you that. You see, a lot of the investment the People's Liberation Army and the PLAN, People's Liberation Army Navy, a lot of the work that they've done over the last 20 years has been aimed at stopping U.S. Navy surface vessels and aircraft. So lots of missiles to sink ships and down fighters. But there's still not much the PLAN can do about the USS Silent Service, our submarines. And while it's not altogether out of the ordinary for a U.S. sub to make port calls in Japan, the Seawolf is a little bit of a different story because it's also a testing platform for new technology that the Navy is developing. Tech which could perhaps go on some of our uncrewed submarines like the Orca or the Ghost Shark, which are both currently in development. So yeah, China cares. If you have any thoughts or questions for us here at the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at weaponsandwarfare@san.com, or you can check in with us on any of our social media pages.
All opinions expressed in this segment are solely the opinions of the contributors.
All right, folks, that's going to just about do it for us this week on Weapons and Warfare. Before we say goodbye, though, I want to spend a few moments on a topic that just might have the most bipartisan support in Congress right now. Disclosure. Specifically, disclosing what some in the government or private sector know about Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon, or UAP. That's how the scientific community now refers to what we all used to call UFOs. But that moniker doesn't really work anymore, because the unidentified objects don't just fly. They also go underwater. Now, before you tune out or call me a crackpot, consider this. In the last year, the House of Representatives held two hearings on the subject of UAPs. The witness lists included current and former members of government, former high-ranking NASA officials, and retired military officers, including aviators and an admiral who spent time on submarines. They were all under oath, and they all said there are vehicles of unknown origin operating in our atmosphere and in our oceans. Vehicles which defy the known laws of physics and display a level of technology orders of magnitude more advanced than anything developed by humans on this planet, at least up to this point in our history. Not only that, but there is evidence showing these UAPs concentrate around military facilities, especially the ones involved in our nuclear triad. And many of the same people who testified before Congress say the UAPs have the ability to interfere with military-grade sensors and weapons control systems. I'm not trying to be an alarmist, and while I may know a few, I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist. But as a journalist, I want to know the truth. based on all the evidence and testimony presented to Congress in just the last year, it seems pretty clear there is an active and ongoing effort within the United States government to conceal the truth about UAPs. There's just no other way to say it. And because of that vacuum of truth, conspiracy theories are allowed to spread unchecked. If daylight truly is the best disinfectant, let's hope this next Congress has the guts to disinfect more disinformation. Those are my thoughts. What about you? Let us know by commenting on our social media feeds or by emailing us at weaponsandwarfare@san.com. For senior producer Brett Baker, video editor Brian Spencer, and graphics artist Dakota Patillo, I'm Ryan Robertson, Straight Arrow News, signing off.